Morning. Welcome to Faith Church. If I haven't met you yet, my name is Godwin, one of the pastors here at Faith Church, and we are going to be in Ecclesiastes chapter 1, and I'm going to start reading in just a few moments in verse 12, and then I'll read through chapter 2, verse 26, so that will be in just a couple moments here. So turn to Ecclesiastes. It's after the book of Psalms, after the book of Proverbs, before the book of Song of Solomons. If you're wondering, where is that book? That's where it is. Ecclesiastes, again, starting to read chapter 1, verse 12 in just a moment here. On May 20th in the year 2000, I found myself near Memphis, Tennessee, with about 40,000 college students listening to a pastor named John Piper. I just turned 20. I was a young Christian, and the guy was preaching very, very passionately, as you may imagine. And I was drinking it up. I mean, I had this new appetite for God's word. So I was just kind of eating up what was being fed to these 40,000 students. And in the middle of driving home, one of his points, he riveted us with this story. And he said a few words afterwards. And I just want to share that with you. So this is from a Reader's Digest. He read this. Bob and Penny took early retirement from their jobs in the Northeast 5 years ago when he was 59 and she was 51. Now they, Bob and Penny, live in Punta Gorda, Florida, where they cruise on their 30-foot trawler, play softball, and collect shells. And then he told all 40,000 of us, here's his commentary, here's his follow-up, here's what he wants us to take away. He says this, he says, that is a tragedy. There are people in this country that are spending billions of dollars to get you to buy into that. And I get 40 minutes to plead with you, don't buy it. With all my heart, this is Piper, not Godwin, with all my heart, I plead with you, don't buy that dream. As the last chapter before, you stand before the creator of the universe to give an account for what you did. You stand there and you say, here it is, Lord, my shell collection. And I've got a good swing. And look at my boat. Well, friends, that sermon, and perhaps that moment in particular, set my life on a different trajectory as a young man. How's that for dramatic? What was underneath Piper's assertion is the notion that to be a Christian is to be a nomad. To be a Christian is to be a misfit. I've always found it interesting and strangely comforting that the Bible describes Christians as sojourners and aliens. We have no permanent roots in this world. We are passing by. We are just traveling through. We are here, but just for now. Cademan's call wonderfully sang about this in the mid-90s. This world has nothing for me, and this world has everything. All that I could want and nothing that I need. The reason, of course, that Piper had to plead with a generation of young people, the reason Cademan's call had to sing those very words, Piper had to plead with people, don't waste your life, is because this world has a powerful allure, does it not? Instead of living as nomads, it is easy for us to live as permanent residents. It's easy to live as if our greatest treasures are in the here and now. Jesus knew that we would be tempted in this manner. And that's why he once said the words that we heard earlier. Let me remind you, don't store up for yourself treasures on earth where moth and rust destroy and where thieves break in and steal, but lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven. And so to stop us from doing the wrong kind of storing and to help us do the right kind of storing, God has provided the book of Ecclesiastes. Let me read this passage. It's a little bit long. Bear with me. I, the teacher, have been king over Israel in Jerusalem. I applied my mind to examine and explore through wisdom all that is done under heaven. God has given people this miserable task to keep them occupied. I have seen all the things that are done under the sun and have found everything to be futile, a pursuit of the wind. What is crooked cannot be straightened. What is lacking cannot be counted. I said to myself, see, I have amassed wisdom far beyond all those who were over Jerusalem before me, and my mind has thoroughly grasped wisdom and knowledge. I've applied my mind to know wisdom and knowledge, madness and folly. I learned that this, too, is a pursuit of the wind. For with much wisdom is much sorrow. As knowledge increases, grief increases. I said to myself, go ahead, I will test you with pleasure. Enjoy what is good. But it turned out to be futile. I said about laughter, it is madness, and about pleasure, what does this accomplish? I explored with my mind the pull of wine on my body, but my mind still guiding me with wisdom and how to grasp folly until I could see what is good for people to do under heaven during the few days of their lives. I increased my achievements. I built houses and planted vineyards for myself. I made gardens and parks for myself and planted every kind of fruit tree in them. I constructed reservoirs for myself from which to irrigate a grove of flourishing trees. I acquired male and female servants, and I had slaves who were born in my house. I also owned livestock, large herds and flocks, more than all who were born before me in Jerusalem. I also amassed silver and gold for myself and the treasure of kings and provinces. I gathered male and female singers for myself and many concubines, the delights of men. So I became great and surpassed all who were before me in Jerusalem. My wisdom also remained with me. All that my eyes desired, I did not deny them. I did not refuse myself any pleasure, for I took pleasure in all my struggles. This was my reward for all my struggles. When I considered all that I had accomplished and what I had labored to achieve, I found everything to be futile and a pursuit of the wind. There was nothing to be gained under the sun. Then I turned to consider wisdom, madness, and folly. For what will the king's successor be like? He will do what has already been done. And I realized there is an advantage to wisdom over folly, like the advantage of light over darkness. The wise person has eyes in his head, but the fool walks in darkness. Yet, I also knew that one fate comes to them both. So I said to myself, what happens to the fool who will also happen to me? Why then have I been overly wise? And I said to myself that this is also futile. For just like the fool, there is no lasting remembrance of the wise, since in the days to come, both will be forgotten. How is it that the wise person dies just like the fool? Therefore, I hated life, because the work that was done under the sun was distressing to me, for everything is futile and a pursuit of the wind. I hated all my work, and I labored at under the sun, because I must leave it to the one who comes after me. And who knows whether he will be wise or a fool? Yet he will take over all my work that I labored at skillfully under the sun. This too is futile. So I began to give myself over to despair concerning all my work that I have labored at under the sun. When there is a person whose work was done with wisdom, knowledge, and skill, and he must give his portion to a person who has not worked for it, this too is futile and a great wrong. For what does a person get with all his work and all his efforts that he labors at under the sun? For all his days are filled with grief, and his occupation is sorrowful. Even at night, his mind does not rest. This too is futile. There is nothing better for a person than to eat, drink, and enjoy his work. I've seen that even this is from God's hand, because who can eat and who can enjoy life apart from him? For to the person who is pleasing in his sight, he gives wisdom, knowledge, and joy. But to the sinner, he gives the task of gathering and accumulating in order to give to the one who is pleasing in God's sight. This too is futile and a pursuit of the wind. This is God's holy and inspired word. Thanks be to God. Here is the main point of the passage and hopefully the sermon in a sentence. You'll see it on the screen as well as in your notes. Here it is. Don't store up treasures on earth for personal gain, but enjoy earthly things as God's temporary gifts. Don't store up treasures on earth for personal gain, but enjoy earthly things as God's temporary gifts. Now, this passage that we're going to tackle this morning, I believe, answers this important question. What is the value of earthly things? What is the value of earthly things? And I think the text answers that question as we walk through these three pretty distinct movements. Here's the first one. We see the teacher's approach. The teacher's approach, looking at verses 12 through 18 of chapter 1. Now, these opening verses are kind of like an abstract or a summary of the extended study that comes in chapter 2. I want you to take note in these opening verses. It seems the teacher is establishing, first of all, his own credibility. Why should we trust this guy? You know, to answer this question that we have, what is the value of earthly things? Well, it turns out, first of all, he's a king. He has used wisdom, notice, to examine and explore all that is done under the sun. He has seen all the things that are done under the sun. In other words, he hasn't left any stone unturned. He's tested and weighed everything on earth. So every human experience, every opportunity and pursuit and desire and pleasure, he's put them all to the test in an effort to find value and meaning. But perhaps the greatest qualification is found in verse 16. Notice what he claims about himself there. He says, "See, I've amassed wisdom far beyond all those who were over Jerusalem before me." Now, if you were here last week, you heard from Dr. Giroux during the Sunday school hour, and he made a case that this is Solomon. I think that's right based on verse 16 alone. Remember, God has given Solomon this high capacity for wisdom. Who else has been king over Israel and could amass such levels of wisdom except for Solomon? So Solomon wants to get to the bottom of this question that he asked back in chapter 1. What is the gain in our toil in this vaporous life? And yet, I want you to notice, as he surveys the task before him, he acknowledges that it's a pretty lousy job. You see that at the end of verse 13? He says, everyone has this task, and it's a miserable thing. Why is this work such an unhappy business? Well, because he's already done the work, and he knows the conclusion. Here's the conclusion. Look at verse 14. I have seen all things that are done under the sun, and here it is, I have found everything, not some things, not most things, but all things, found everything to be futile, vapor, temporary, fleeting. That's the word hebel we learned last week. He says a pursuit of the wind. So everything everyone does in this life, according to the great wise Solomon, is temporary. It's like trying to shepherd the wind, corral the wind, guide the wind, lead the wind in a meaningful direction. That's basically impossible. Then in verse 15, notice he discovers that he can't make the world different for how it actually is. He finds that it is crooked. It's bent out of shape. Friends, there will always be parts of this life that remain mysterious and unbearably complex. Ian Proven tells a story of seeing this exceptional philosophy major student in college, and he remembers vividly seeing this young man sitting with a bottle of vodka in his hand, rhythmically banging his head against a wall in the middle of a party. How can someone so brilliant, someone so gifted, someone who's got such a wonderful future ahead of him, in the context of this joyful party, be so distraught? Well, because he too, like the teacher of Ecclesiastes, chased the wind and he found life wanting. Notice again verses 16 through 18. The teacher, notice, he visits Jerusalem University. He studies, he grows in wisdom. He learns from every professor and passes every exam with flying colors. He's not only studies sane things, but he studies madness and folly to see what light they will shed. He learns so much, and yet what comes from all of this study? Look at the end of verse 17 with me. He says, I applied my mind to know wisdom and knowledge, madness and folly. I learned that this too is a pursuit of the wind. For with much wisdom is much sorrow. As knowledge increases, grief increases too. So he learns so much, but his heart continues to ache. Degree certificates are lining up his office walls. But his tears are the same as the person working on the street who never went to school. With wisdom, friends, comes pain. I think we have the idea that with more education comes more happiness. With more knowledge comes greater security. You know, you go to school and you study hard and you get into a good college and you acquire a top job and you contribute to society and you make lots of money. This is the life. This is the way. The teacher says, actually, the more you know, the more you will feel pain and frustration. That's what he says. This is the teacher's version of Bob Seger's famous lyric, I wish I didn't know now what I didn't know then. If you wrestle with the Hebel life, if you see the bent things in this world, you will know pain. It's why we can sing, even as Christians on this side of Jesus' life, death, and resurrection, even as Christians, we can sing the words that we sang before. Do you feel this world is broken? Do you feel the shadows deepen? And is all creation groaning? We can sing these words, even as Christians. Only the person who has done the work of testing this world for value will be able to ask those very questions and be able to feel the pain and the longing behind those questions. It's not the end of the story. We know that, but it's part of the story. Ecclesiastes invites us into these feelings. It invites us to feel our limitations and then to surrender and to accept what we find. So that's the teacher's approach. Here's the teacher's experiments, chapter 2, verses 1 through 23. Now, chapter 2 is constructed very carefully. The phrase, you probably saw this as I was reading, the phrase, a pursuit of the wind, is introduced in chapter 1. We've already seen that. And then it's used three times to frame chapter 2. In fact, it's carefully placed at the end of each of the teacher's experiments. So he tests pleasure at the beginning, he tests wise living in the middle, and then he tests work at the end of chapter 2, and its conclusion is the same for each of them. All is vapor. All is a striving, a chasing after the wind. So let's walk through each of these three experiments, starting with pleasure. Notice chapter 2, verse 1. I said to myself, go ahead, I will test you with pleasure. Enjoy what is good. So he's exploring pleasure to see if it's going to numb the pain and numb the frustration of Hebel. According to verse 2, notice, the teacher begins by hitting the Hebrew comedy clubs. And he starts tasting wine at Israel's finest vineyards. I wonder whether you've read the autobiography of a comedian. Too often we find them as some of the loneliest and saddest people on earth because the show ends. The party stops, and people have to drive home, and you are still left there with your thoughts. Now what? So there's an emptiness there for many comedians, and many of us, of course. That's a picture of our lives at times as well. Notice in verses 4 and following, Solomon starts to stockpile houses and vineyards and fruit trees and servants and livestock and singers and concubines. He literally has it all, wine and wealth and women. Verse 2:10 is a great summary. He says, all that my eyes desired, I did not deny them. I did not refuse myself any pleasure, for I took pleasure in all my struggles. This was my reward for all my struggles. But I think as we examine the verses in between, verses 4 through 9, there's something really interesting that's happening. I think we see, we find something here that's reminiscent of something we find in the earlier chapters of the Bible. Isn't the teacher reconstructing his own private Garden of Eden? It's almost like he took Genesis' dominion mandate so seriously. He starts to build houses and he draws up plans and he gathers materials and he plants vineyards and he tends to his gardens and develops irrigation technology. He amasses liquid assets and solid assets. He gathers art and real estate. His business portfolio is growing while he also seeks after the more refined pleasures like music. So he's trying to recreate God's paradise on earth. But friends, you and I know this. It can't be done in this life. This world is fallen. This world is cursed. God has placed a fracture in the fabric of the universe, to quote David Gibson. So things are not what they should be. We simply cannot bring the Garden of Eden back to earth. The world has tried. Solomon has tried. And it's impossible. I'm reminded of Errol Flynn. Who knows Errol Flynn? Raise your hand. The old people. I didn't say it, you did. So here's a quick overview of Errol Flynn's life. Okay, he's an Australian actor. He's known for his romantic, swashbuckling roles in Hollywood. He's known also for his party lifestyle, including addictions to drugs and alcohol. He was a renowned womanizer. He had 3 failed marriages, died early of a heart attack. So this guy lived for pleasure. In fact, when he died in the late 50s, one writer declared him to be a high priest of hedonism. Now, how would you like that on your tombstone, you know? Jeremy Bentham, a 19th century philosopher who popularized hedonism, he described or defined it like this. He said, "Nature has placed man under the governance of two sovereign masters, pain and pleasure." Fascinating. And so the life of a hedonist is avoiding pain and indulging in pleasure at all costs. And so what the teacher is testing is if that worldview works. Does hedonism work? Will pleasure satisfy? Can you really avoid pain? And what is the teacher's conclusions to these questions? We'll look at the end of verse 11. What does he say? "I found everything to be futile in a pursuit of the wind. There is nothing to be gained under the sun." So he weighs comedy and pleasure and alcohol and women and possessions. And as he did, he held happiness in his hands. He very likely had a sense of elation as he kind of looked at his human kingdom. But then he started to feel it slip through his fingers. The refrain from U2's Bono probably hit him hard if Bono was back in the day. "But I still haven't found what I'm looking for." Blaise Pascal famously has said, "All men seek happiness. This is without exception. This is the motive of every action of every man, even of those who hang themselves." I think Pascal is right. Just about everything we've done today, woke up, fed ourselves, showered, dressed, did our hair, you know, maybe makeup or whatever you do in the mornings, driving to church, coming here, in fact, all these things are motivated at least in part by our own happiness. We long to be happy. In every pursuit, we want to feel pleasure. Ecclesiastes doesn't deny that. It denies that you will find lasting, ultimate pleasure in something in this life. A husband, friends, won't ultimately fill the void. Wealth won't scratch the itch. That dream job won't give you the happiness your soul longs for. Living a debaucherous life filled with drugs and sex and all kinds of things won't make the pain go away. So that's the first experiment. What about the second? Here he tests, notice in verses 12 through 14, he tests the wise life. "Then I turn to consider wisdom, madness, and folly, for what will the king's successor be like? He will do what he has already, or what has already been done. And I realize that there is an advantage to wisdom over folly, like the advantage of light over darkness. The wise person has eyes in his head, but the fool walks in darkness." So a wise life has its limitations, but at the end of the day, wisdom is still indispensable. According to verse 14, a wise person can see. A foolish person, meanwhile, walks in darkness. The teacher then takes an interesting turn at the end of verse 14 and following. Wisdom in this life is very important, but it doesn't cure everything. In fact, he says wisdom is better than folly, but according to verse 16, it can't stop death. Doesn't matter how wise you are, you don't hold the power, you don't wield the authority to stop death. And so the wise person dies right alongside the foolish person. It's kind of depressing, isn't it? I mean, wow, here we are back again. You walked into Sunday morning service here and you're thinking, "I need a word of comfort from the Lord." We gotta wait a little bit longer. It's gonna come at the end of chapter 2, okay? It's coming. But I know you're feeling it with me. It's okay. You know, we're gonna hold your head underwater for a while, because that's what the teacher does. And then we're gonna come out of the water, okay? Notice how he concludes in verse 17. "Therefore, I hated life." Ugh. "I hated life because the work that was done under the sun was distressing to me. For everything is futile and a pursuit of the wind." Why does he hate life? I mean, is he just kind of throwing a temper tantrum? You know, is this kind of an emotional response to what he's thinking about? No, friends, this is a thoughtful and calculated response to this experiment. The fall has made even wisdom temporary in its benefits. This is the design of God's judgment. It's nothing new. He gets it. His bubble bursts, and all that's left is pain and frustration. So His hatred, this is important, his hatred is a mark of piety. It's not a mark of bitterness, okay? Now, look at the final experiment that he conducts in verses 18 and following. He focuses on toil and labor. Verse 18 says, I hated all my work that I labored at under the sun because I must leave it to the one who comes after me. And who knows whether he will be wise or a fool, yet he will take over all my work that I labored at skillfully under the sun. This too is futile. Will there be anything lasting to gain from all the efforts that you labor at and I labor at in this life? And his answer is essentially not really. Someone's going to take over his work and his possessions, and while he is wise, what's to say that his riches and his work aren't going to fall in the lap of a fool? Once again, we've returned to the reality of death and the despair that comes from recognizing death. It is the people who follow us who will have control over our gains. Hey, maybe they're going to develop those things that we've invested in and poured our life into, or maybe they'll destroy it. Either way, we will be dead and gone and soon forgotten. That's where he lands. I like that line. I hated all my work that I labored at under the sun. You see that in verse 18? It sounds like the adult version of Christmas morning. I mean, the kinds of efforts that go into Christmas is just absurd. Let's be honest, okay? From the tree and the house decorations and the music and the gatherings and the cookie decorating and, of course, the presents. Oh, my. You know, the presents, right? All the efforts going into creatively and efficiently and, you know, generously, but then you only have limited accounts. You're selecting these gifts, right, for your family members and wrapping these gifts, and it's just it just takes forever. And then the anticipation for a five-year-old is going through the roof, right, whether it's your grandson or whether it's your child or your niece or nephew. Who can sleep on Christmas Eve? Well, mom and dad can certainly sleep on Christmas Eve. We're in bed, probably early. We're ready to sleep in, right? But then 6 a.m. finally rolls around, you know? And gifts are passed around because they all wake, you know, we're awake fairly early at that point. And gifts are passed around, and then our five-year-old selves start to wonder, if you kind of go back and think about when you were five, could this be the present that I've wanted my whole life that will effectively change the trajectory of my life for good? And then eager anticipation gives way to joy. Like, look what I got. Like, this is amazing. Mom heard the comment I made 2 months ago. Dad, probably not so much, but mom did, you know? But then inevitably, friends, what happens? As we stand over our massive hall, it's over. It's all over. This is what the teacher's talking about. The buildup only leads to a letdown. The toy is wonderful for a time, but eventually it breaks or we lose interest in it. Is all the anticipation worth such a letdown? As we look at all these experiments, pleasure, wise living, work, we recognize in them all this hunger for more. We recognize this hunger for permanence, this hunger for significance. It's this hunger, according to the teacher, that is never satisfied in this life. You know, Christmas is wonderful, but every year it has an end point. It's like a good hearty meal is filling. Sure, it fills us up. A mere 3 hours later, we're hungry again. The teacher feels this pain. It's the pain of the Hebel life, the vaporous life. What do we do with this? Well, one temptation is to refuse to think about it entirely. Like, don't think about death or misery or folly and the lack of lasting gain by, you know, any of that stuff. Let's not think about that at all. And what do we do instead? Well, we fill our lives up with pleasure and self-help, wisdom and work. We console ourselves with distraction and diversion rather than face the reality of our own spiritual bankruptcy and poverty and limitations. We try to numb the feelings of Hebel with more Hebel. It's fascinating. That's our tendency. But earthly things cannot fully console heavenly longings. That's what we learn as we read this book. Pascal suggests that, quote, the soul The sole cause of a man's unhappiness is that he does not know how to stay quietly in his room. Think about that. I'll say it again. It's great. The sole cause of man's unhappiness is that he does not know how to stay quietly in his room. And what is he talking about there? Is he talking about like you just need to, everybody just needs to go and isolate? He's not talking about that. He's saying that silence feels too uncomfortable for us because it forces us to face the reality of Hebel. And so we putz around on our phones or we escape with a movie or we, worse, give ourselves to secret sins. We are busy with numbing our pain. We haven't discovered that facing the pain, accepting our limitations, is the first step to real joy. Okay, so far the teacher has kind of burst the bubbles of pleasure and wise living and work, and he's used death in particular as the sharp point to burst those bubbles. In other words, we are limited. We are going to die. Thankfully, the teacher brings us up for some air in these final verses. Okay, so put your eyes in verses 24 through 26. Here we find the teacher's conclusions. Let me read these verses for you. There's nothing better for a person than to eat, drink, and enjoy his work. I have seen that even this is from God's hand. Because who can eat and who can enjoy life apart from him? For to the person who is pleasing in his sight, he gives wisdom, knowledge, and joy. But to the sinner, he gives the task of gathering and accumulating in order to give to the one who is pleasing in God's sight. This too is futile and a pursuit of the wind. Now, at first glance, doesn't seem like there's much here. He says, eat, drink, and enjoy your work. Okay? I mean, isn't that kind of the nihilist creed? Eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die? That's not what he's saying. That's not what he's saying. You know, some people say, eat, drink, and be merry because that's all there is. The teacher says, eat, drink, and be merry because that's what there is. Notice the emphasis in these verses. Over and over again, we see the emphasis is that God gives. He gives food and he gives work. He gives wisdom and knowledge and joy and enjoyment itself. They are all gifts from God. And yes, even the enjoyment of them is fleeting and temporary according to how things end in verse 26. But there's a lesson here from us. So I'm going to spend the last few minutes of our time really pressing into this. When we accept that we are going to die, we can stop expecting too much of the good things in this life. Do you hear that? Instead of expecting too much of the good things in this life, we can learn to receive those things for what they are in themselves, rather than what we need them to be to make us happy. Instead of using God's gifts as a means of securing personal gain, we take the time to live inside those gifts themselves and see God's goodness in them. So let's think about this a little bit. Why do we eat? And why do we work? We eat so we can be refueled, so we can keep working. And we work to find satisfaction and purpose and often to build a reputation and build up our resumes. Is that right? What if the pleasure of food and the pleasure of company around the table became a daily joy? Simple pleasures, friends. What if our work was never intended to make us successful, but simply to make us good stewards of the skills God gave us? And what if death reminds us that this is how we should live? We tend to use the world around us as leverage to achieve our own goals. They are means to conquer life for our own ends. The teacher tells us in these verses that life cannot be leveraged. Life is meant to be enjoyed, not mastered. Because we are creatures, we have limitations, we will die. Like we talked about last week, our tendency is to squeeze out of this life what it was never meant to give us. The teacher says God's gifts, and he gives gifts to be enjoyed within this temporary life. In other words, hear me now, God's gifts make poor gods. God's gifts make poor gods. What spoils God's gifts is our hunger to get out of them more than what they can give. Eating, drinking, working aren't rewards to be earned. but gifts to be enjoyed for a brief time. When we realize we are not meant to rule the world or master our destiny or achieve ultimate gain through our careers, then we are free to discover that enjoyment itself is the reward we should expect from the life that God has given us. If you're a Christian, you probably thank God, hopefully, each day for one of your meals. Maybe it's dinner around the table with your family. Hey, that's a great simple application of our study this morning. What about thanking God tomorrow morning for the work of your hands? What about thanking God tomorrow for the family that he has given you? What about thanking God tomorrow and Tuesday and Wednesday for the pleasure of accomplishment, for the pleasure perhaps of a good vacation that is coming or maybe that you've just had? What about thanking God for the good friends that you have invited over for a dinner party at your home? Are you in the business of thanking God for the simple blessings, the simple things that he has given you to enjoy? They're for you to enjoy. They're not for your personal gain. Notice what we see in verse 26. The teacher takes it a step further. Look at verse 26 with me. For to the person who is pleasing in his sight, he gives wisdom, knowledge, and joy. But to the sinner, he gives the task of gathering and accumulating in order to give to the one who is pleasing in God's sight. So God gives more, according to this verse, he gives more to his people, to those who are pleasing in his sight. He gives more. He gives more to them than those outside his flock. And so in this verse, we see two distinct gifts. I want to point this out to you. It's really interesting. God gives gifts, and he gives the gift of enjoying these gifts. Okay? So these are two different, distinct gifts, kind of like a can of peaches and a can opener. Those are two distinct gifts, right? The first is given to both unbelievers and believers. That's the can of peaches. Everybody has a can of peaches. The second gift, the can opener, is given uniquely to the believer, the one who's pleasing to God. Because only he, the believer, can fully recognize God's goodness in the gifts. Hope you're catching what I'm saying here. Joe Rigney speaks of this in his book, The Things of Earth, which I highly recommend to you. Think about God's gift of literature and philosophy. Now, you might be thinking, well, Pastor, some of that is godless and pagan and has nothing to do with the Christian worldview. And I would say, yeah, absolutely, that is the case with some things. But how many people, listen now, how many people have been primed to receive the gospel because they have read the Chronicles of Narnia as kids? And how much medieval philosophy and classical poetry and fantasy fiction did C.S. Lewis have to read before he was equipped to write those wonderful books? Do you hear what I'm saying? Lewis is an example of the person pleasing in God's sight in verse 26. In other words, he received the can of peaches, but he also has the can opener. And look at what's come from it. The fruit in your life, as you and your children have perhaps read that very series. Think about the can of fathering for just a moment. What might the can opener open up for us here? My 4-year-old Lucy will often walk up to me, arms outstretched, and I can see in her eyes that she is searching for something. She's searching for approval and affirmation and affection, something that only a father perhaps can give. And she is hungry for her father's love. She's hungry for the father's love. The temporary, vaporous fathering she will receive from me is a gift. Hopefully it is a gift that will turn her attention to the heavenly Father's love. She's reaching for me, but she's looking for God. Rigney comments, quote, "Either the laughter in my eyes, the smile on my face, and the strength and tenderness of my arms will tell the truth about God, or their absence will blaspheme the Father of lights." Every human on this planet has a can of peaches, access to good books, access to a father or a mother. But not every human being is capable of fully enjoying the can. The ultimate story that all those good books point to, the ultimate father that all those good fathers point to. Friends, Solomon was supremely wise, but even he didn't know the half of it. He doesn't know the giver like we do. We recognize today that we have the can opener. We have the ability to enjoy God's gifts because we have been reconciled to God through Jesus. In fact, Jesus is our greatest gift. Why do I say that? Listen carefully. Because through his life, death, and resurrection, sinners, those who are living under the sun, living fallen lives, sinners are reconciled to God. We escape the fallen world. We are released from our enslavement to sin. We are released from our verdict, which is guilty before a holy God. So the giver's greatest gift, listen, the giver's greatest gift is himself. He and he alone can satisfy you. There's nothing higher or lovelier or more precious or more valuable than Jesus himself, the giver who gives you himself. And if you are a Christian, you have him. Death will not pull that gift from you. In fact, death will only bring you closer to Jesus. You know, the Apostle Paul understood this so well, which is why he said in Philippians chapter 3 that he counts everything, not most things, some things. He said everything he counts as a loss compared to the surpassing worth of knowing Jesus Christ. Jesus is your greatest treasure on earth. But there's one more step we need to take. Jesus is also the greatest gift because he is the can opener. He shows us how to properly enjoy this life. He shows us how to enjoy this life without storing up treasures on earth. He is the one who helps us make sense of this life and give each part of this life proper weight and proportion. By his example, by his teaching, he helps us to enjoy this life as it should. How does he do this? Oh, he works through his Spirit. He works, of course, in this book. He guides us in this. Friends, we cannot fully obey what we see here at the end of chapter 2 of Ecclesiastes without fully knowing Jesus. So, brothers and sisters, enjoy this life for what it is, as Christ would have you. Derive pleasure from the simple things of this life. Don't try to suck out of this life what it was never meant to give you. Don't try to leverage people or money or opportunities for personal gain, but rather enjoy this life. Enjoy music and the arts and good literature and knowledge. Enjoy friendships and family and food and labor and work. Enjoy them as ones who amazingly have the can opener in our hands. Amen. Let's take a moment now to prepare ourselves for the Lord's Supper, as well as ponder the passage here before us.